Hello, everyone. I'm Viviana Young, the Environmental Education and Outreach Leader for Umpqua Watersheds through United Communities AmeriCorps, and the host of Living Downstream.
Umpqua Watersheds values both human and ecological diversity. We celebrate the strengths and perspectives that different people have to offer and believe that organizations, communities, and ecosystems are all more resilient when they embrace the unique gifts various individuals can contribute. We acknowledge that the land upon which Umpqua Watersheds is located was formerly occupied and tended by various indigenous groups, including Cow Creek Umpqua, Coquille, Molalla, and others. Their history is intertwined with this place, and we seek to continue to practice stewardship and reciprocity towards the natural environment, which indigenous people did for thousands of years prior to European settlement.
So today with us, we have Alexandra Harding, a local teacher at a middle school. Hello, Alex. What and where do you teach?
Hello. I teach plant science and environmental studies at Joseph Lane Middle School here in Roseburg.
And how long have you been teaching?
This is my fourth year in Roseburg, and prior to moving here, I taught for several years in Southern Oregon, both outdoor education, substituting, and at a local charter school. So I'd say maybe about 6 years.
Cool. And how did you become a teacher?
Originally, I did not think I wanted to get into teaching. I was studying biology and doing outdoor field studies, and I worked with a local soil and watershed district doing some things for Department of Fish and Wildlife. And part of that was we did a volunteer activity at a local fair with some kids. And I also worked with adults, educating them on land maintenance as regards to interacting with wildlife. And while doing that, I realized that the most fun that I had wasn't when I was, you know, out in the field or working on my computer or anything like that. The most fun that I had was when I was interacting with other people. And that's when I started looking into teaching.
Cool. And so it sounds like you have an interest in environmental education specifically. Do you have a degree in that?
Yes. So I have a degree in environmental education from Southern Oregon University. There's a master's program there specifically for environmental ed. While I was there, I added on, they have a dual degree program. So I did environmental education at the same time that I was doing my master's of arts in teaching. So that gives you a lot of options. I could work in places like outdoor schools, museums, nonprofits, things like that. But I can also work in the school districts. And a lot of people with that sort of degree end up working during the school year with a school district. And then during the summer, they work in the outdoors using their environmental education experience.
We became acquainted when I began coming into your classroom to help out with some projects and loan some materials to you. How did you find out about AmeriCorps and Umpqua Watersheds?
So I had heard about Umpqua Watersheds when I first moved here through the previous AmeriCorps volunteer, and they had reached out, I think, to the science teachers at our school in an email just to introduce us to the program that was available and what their role was. And then also listening to the radio and hearing little segments about Umpqua Watersheds and the activities that they were doing and the education that they were doing. That was the two primary sources, I guess.
Do you have any other connections with AmeriCorps?
I don't. I have had friends and acquaintances in the past that worked with AmeriCorps or had different projects going on in association, but this is my first experience working with someone directly.
So what has been your favorite project over the past year, whether connected to Umpqua Watersheds or not?
Okay, so I had been waiting to teach an elective class. My first few years here were just science, which I really enjoy. We do a mix of life science, earth science, and physical science, but it didn't really incorporate the amount of environmental education and place-based education specifically that I wanted to bring to the table, especially because of my background. So I taught plant science first semester, which involved a lot of hands-on lab explorations and things of plants. And then this semester I taught environmental studies, which is really where we finally got to do some of the topics that I had been waiting to explore. And my favorite activity that we did actually, well, there were several. I did a lot of art projects, but the one that I really enjoyed was the one that I did with you. And that was the environmental detectives unit.
The students got really into that. They were the detectives trying to solve an environmental mystery catastrophe. And they got to play the roles of the various characters and do the lab investigations. And eventually, I don't know why they were surprised, but they were surprised to discover that there was not one culprit, but many culprits in environmental issues. And that was a several week long project that we did that I feel like they really got a lot out of, and they still talk about it.
It's great to hear that they enjoyed it so much. So two projects that you considered doing in the future were Gyotaku fish prints and animal track making, both art projects, and you mentioned art just now. So over the past few years, STEM has increasingly become STEAM. Do you think that art contributes greatly to education? And if so, in what ways?
Yeah, STEAM is becoming really big. Originally, when I first started teaching, I did a lot of STEM projects. I did a lot of engineering projects. And what I've come to really enjoy about STEAM is that it draws in a lot of the students that wouldn't necessarily be engaging with the sciences or environmental education. It draws in those students kind of sometimes on the fringe that maybe in the world of education, art is really the one thing that gets them coming to school sometimes, or the one thing that they can participate with that doesn't have the same academic barriers. And it draws in a lot of different personalities. So I'd say art has a lot of value just because of that. You don't have to be an excellent reader or excellent at math or any of those things to be able to access it. It's really open to anyone. And so when I started incorporating that into the classroom, I started seeing more students who were excited to get their projects out right away when they got to class. They wanted to work independently, and they really liked that element of being an individual and choosing how their art was going to look and what they were going to do with it. And it really helped me pull in some scientific and environmental issues without them being resistant to it.
I think another thing about art is that it kind of goes across all age ranges. It's a great tool for helping young kids, teenagers, even adults. It can really bring science into a whole range of minds.
Exactly. I realized that some of the art projects that I was doing with my middle schoolers were art projects that they had probably already done in elementary school or as youngsters, but they get a whole different experience out of it doing it as an older student. They have a different understanding of it now.
I recently joined you on a hiking field trip. What would you say are the benefits of outdoor activities like that?
So the hiking field trip, we went to Wolf Creek Falls, which is a local trail, a local waterfall. And I think one of the benefits of incorporating that, especially into the classroom, is that I have many students who have lived in the Roseburg area in the Umpqua Valley their whole lives, but have never had the opportunity to see nature. It's so crazy to me that you could live in a place and just really be in the urban areas and the neighborhoods and things like that, but never get out and really understand the place that you live. And so that's part of the place-based education that I'm trying to incorporate. And it was really nice because as part of my plant science class, they had learned how to identify lots of local plants. And they had learned how to identify lots of different local wildlife and insects and things like that. So as they were on the trail, they were saying, oh, look, there's that plant we learned about. There's that insect we learned about. And it really gives them a different view of the place that they live.
So you mentioned that you don't think that kids are necessarily getting outside enough before they get to your classroom. But in general, in your opinion, do you think kids in our area are getting enough environmental education? Do the kids already have a solid foundation to build on by the time they get to you?
So many of my kids have attended outdoor schools or summer camps or things like that. Maybe their families fish or hunt, especially in this area. And so they might have some experience, especially the kids that have families or schools that have placed an emphasis on that. So I'd say I do have some foundation. We live in a really great area for people to be able to access things like that, especially thinking about the Umpqua River and the opportunities that that gives for families just to access the river and nature within just a few minutes of where they live. But as far as applying it to what they're learning in school, I think there's a disconnect. They haven't really realized that it's part of that bigger picture, and maybe even understand a little bit about some of the environmental issues that are threatening local wildlife or wild spaces. And it really gives them just kind of a deeper understanding.
So speaking of wildlife or just animals, you have a classroom pet, isn't that right?
Yeah, I have a large ball python named Pretzel, and Pretzel is very famous. I have a lot of students that are in other classes that haven't met me before, and I have them coming into my classroom just to meet Pretzel and to ask questions about the snake. And I have students that play a game every day when they get into the classroom of, where's the snake? And they have to come and look in the enclosure and figure out where the snake has hidden itself the night before. So it's been really exciting for them.
I think one thing that you said one of the first times I met you in that classroom was that the nice thing about Pretzel as well was that kids typically aren't tempted to touch him when you're not necessarily looking. Yeah. So that does bring up a drawback of having typical classroom pets. Can you think of any other drawbacks?
Well, the safety factor is one. Since Pretzel is new to our school, I really carefully supervise visits. And so no one else is allowed to hold the snake. They're just allowed to pet the snake. It's a really easygoing, docile pet, actually. I let my 5-year-old daughter hold it. I'm not too concerned about that. But the risk of having the classroom pet is that having students interact with it, I would say the higher risk is having the pet get injured compared to having a student get injured. I also have Madagascar hissing cockroaches, and I do let students hold those. They don't bite. They can't hurt you in any way. And the higher risk is that they will injure the insect, actually, by being scared by the hissing sound. Some other things to think about if you do want to incorporate a class pet are, as the teacher, being responsible for the care means that you also have that pet during the summer when you're not in the classroom. And you also have to think about winter break and spring break and how to arrange care for the animals.
Well, your example with the roaches, I think, brings up another great benefit to having classroom pets, in that it teaches kids to not be needlessly afraid of certain animals. I know that a lot of people, especially young kids, are kind of taught to fear these animals that are not necessarily dangerous, like garter snakes, by showing them that even the more spooky looking animals aren't actually necessarily as dangerous as they've been taught, I think is really beneficial.
I chose the class pets that I've chosen specifically for that reason. In the past, I had ant farms and things like that, that they're not fuzzy and cute, but especially the hissing cockroaches and spiders and things like that have been really useful. And another thing that's been useful is to show my students and tell them that my 5-year-old holds these. You are safe. You won't be injured. They're actually really friendly. And it's kind of a gateway pet to the other animals in nature, like garter snakes and things that really should be respected and enjoyed when you see them in nature, instead of running away or actually trying to injure the animal when you find it in nature.
So overall, would you recommend classroom pets?
Definitely. It's worth the extra work, and it really engages your students and makes them excited to come into the classroom every day. I have some students that absolutely hate doing classwork. Maybe writing isn't their forte, or math, or anything like that. But if I dangle the carrot of, well, you get to hold Frankie today at the end of class, then they are there for it.
What's your favorite kind of classroom experience? Do you prefer writing projects, videos, hands-on experiments, anything like that?
My personal preference is to do hands-on experiments, labs, even if it's just observing something and, for example, using a microscope, observing something under the microscope and drawing it or writing about what you see. I enjoy the hands-on, right there in your face sort of experiences. But I also understand that that's not the way that every student learns. So some of my students really prefer to read about it, to watch a video about it, to write about it. And so what I've started doing more of is choice-based assignments. So for example, we just did a unit on biodiversity, and my teaching partner and I gave them a menu of the different options that they had to learn about biodiversity. And some of them were hands-on, some of them were artistic, some of them were more math-based, and letting the students choose how they want to engage with the content creates more participation.
So with hands-on being your favorite type, I imagine COVID really affected your classroom a lot. Did it?
Yes. So last year during COVID, we transitioned from science being a year-long course to science being just one semester. So that was one thing. And then also absolutely no hands-on for almost a year. So all of my lab activities and things that I had planned into my full year course had to be cut out. And teaching online created very large challenges, especially in the science department. I did a lot of demonstrations where I was doing the labs and talking about it. And it almost felt like I had my own TV show or something, like I was a Bill Nye character because I was doing the labs and I had to explain, oh, this is what it feels like, this is what it smells like to the kids. And they actually really enjoyed watching it. It's not the same as doing it, but there was still, I guess, I was hands-on, they were visually enjoying that.
Have things mostly gone back to normal by now?
Yes, there are some things that I think have changed for the long term, but for the most part, the classroom experience is back to normal.
And have you adopted any new techniques or perspectives because of it?
Yes. So the things that are changing more long-term is that in the past, I did everything paper and pencil and in person in the classroom. And now every teacher on campus has an online classroom as well, which has been extremely useful. So some of my teaching techniques in my online classroom are to provide videos and links to websites with educational games or things like that. I have assignments that students get to record audio or video of themselves responding to something. I have editable PDFs where students can mark up while they read and highlight and do all these things. I never had any of that before. So it's proven really useful.
Do you think that teaching styles or project types or curriculum have changed a lot since you were in middle school, pertaining to environmental education or just in general?
I think when I was in middle school, really the only environmental education that I had access to was going to outdoor school. And even then, not every school did outdoor school. That was before the outdoor school for all, the mandate that students had to have access to that was there. So I was really fortunate to be able to attend an outdoor school and fall in love with nature and environmental education from a really young age. Not everyone had that. Science education in the past, I did have hands-on experiences, but it was a lot more textbook-based than hands-on or than experiential.
So do you have any tips for homeschooling parents or parents that just want to continue the learning process at home with their kid?
I think my number one tip would be to make a list of your local resources like Umpqua Watersheds, the public library, other nonprofits. There are usually educational kits or books or experiences that you can get for free just by asking and exploring your local resources. And I guess another tip would be just to follow your child's interests and let them explore. Environmental education does not have to be fancy. It could just be going outside in your backyard.
Do you have a favorite resource online that you like to draw from?
I mean, as a teacher, this sounds kind of silly, but Instagram is a great place to find like-minded people. And actually, just as a parent, I follow a lot of environmentalist parents. homeschooling or unschooling or nature schooling, forest school. All of those are topics that are kind of niche, especially in our area. But when you get on Instagram or YouTube or places like that, you can find community really quickly. So I have found community on Instagram, especially for forest schooling and unschooling, that has benefited me as a teacher just to get ideas of how to get students outside, projects, art, online resources, books, all of that, just by connecting with other people online. So that's been really useful.
I think it's actually great that you're embracing the changing times. I know that there can be some resistance, but it is important to note that a lot of our young people are on these platforms like Instagram and YouTube. And so it's a great way to reach people, adults included. You have a kid yourself, is that right?
Yeah, I have a 5-year-old.
And how is your approach to teaching your younger child about natural resources and respecting nature different than your approach with older kids in their teens? And is it the same in any way?
I would say my approach, especially with my own daughter, is just exposure and exploration and noticing. So whether it's in our garden or in our backyard, or if I take her on a hike with me, it's just to have her there alongside with me. And if we find something, for example, a garter snake while we're hiking, wow, what do you notice about this snake? What is it doing? Where was it? Asking a lot of questions and just letting her make her own observations. I try not to, even if I'm nervous about something, to let that affect her. So for example, yesterday we found a jumping spider and she picked it up totally fine. Okay. And I said, wow, what's that spider doing? Where was it? How do you think that spider feels right now? Because it was in our house. And she held it up to her face. I love this spider. I can't think of many kids, especially in my classroom, that would fall in love with a spider like that, simply because they weren't allowed just to explore and develop their own opinions about nature and wild animals. They were influenced, I guess, by other people's fears. When I take my daughter outside, it's really just to let her have fun and explore. And really, that same thing works with older kids as well. So with my middle schoolers, just letting them notice what they notice. Young people are so observant and they pick up on things that maybe you wouldn't expect that they would pick up on just by allowing them to.
Do you think that living in Oregon really affects the way that we're taught about nature?
I would say that in Oregon, nature's kind of right in your face, whether or not you like it, right? We live in a really beautiful state with really easy access to natural areas. It's not so in other states. In other states, if you want to do environmental education in the city, you have to be very creative or go on field trips or outdoor school at a different location. Here, I can look out the window with my kids and we see wild turkeys and deer and things on our hillside. That's really special. And it makes it a lot easier for kids to access. If they fall in love with hiking, for example, like the field trip that we just did, they can take their families back there really easily.
The culture is a bit different here too, though, wouldn't you say?
Yes. I'm new to the Roseburg area. So to me, meeting the kids, I have learned a lot about the culture in this area. And that's actually how I came to understand that fishing and hunting were so big here. A lot of my students fish, and that is one of their favorite pastimes. They're learning about nature and environmental studies and environmental issues without even realizing it, just by being a fisher person.
So what are you looking forward to in the next year?
Something I'm really looking forward to, there's a few things. This summer, I'm teaching a summer class for Roseburg Public Schools. They do it here at the middle school and kids can sign up. And I'm teaching wildlife studies along with my teaching partner. I'm excited about that. And I'm excited to expand more on my electives, my plant science and my environmental studies. I'm hoping to incorporate more project-based learning, more hands-on, more art integration, and really just kind of fine-tuning what I've been doing already.
That sounds exciting. Do you have any closing comments, announcements, or thoughts?
Well, as far as an announcement goes, since I'm teaching environmental studies again, I'm really hoping to incorporate some guest speakers into the curriculum from maybe like local organizations, local nonprofits, even public agencies. I just want to expose the kids to maybe like career options or volunteer opportunities in the community. So if there's someone who hears this and feels really drawn to do that, that would be amazing, or even has resources that I haven't heard of. I think networking within your community is a great way to improve on making place-based education a reality. And I think my other closing comment would just be that you don't need to have a master's degree in environmental education to incorporate that into the classroom, into life at home with your kids, just on a personal level. Really just getting outside, exploring nature, learning about local issues can be really simple and really easy and accessible to anyone of lots of different ability levels. You don't have to go on a 5-mile hike to be able to appreciate nature close to you. So my encouragement is just to get out there and do it.
You have a lot of great words of advice. Thank you so much for appearing on Living Downstream, Alex.
Thank you.
And now for some brief announcements.
This Saturday, June 18th, join Elkton Community Education Center for the return of the Blooms and Butterflies event. Elkton Community Education Center's Butterfly Gardens and Native Plant Park are the backdrops for this annual celebration. The festivities start with Hatha Yoga at 8:30 and the scenic 5K butterfly run or walk along the river from 9 to 11 a.m. Dress up like a butterfly and enter the costume contest by 11:30. You do not have to run to enter the costume contest, but running in costume is encouraged. Prizes will be awarded for the best costumes in the 3 runner categories and for the cutest pet. Enjoy live music all day from flutes to banjos. This year features special entertainment just for kids. All event proceeds support Elkton Community Education Center's programs. Check out the Elkton Community Education Center website for more details. We hope you'll join us.
Another upcoming opportunity is the U Creek Youth Campout on June 24th through the 26th. This fun summer weekend adventure is filled with science and outdoor activities for local youths, ages 12 through 17, and their families. At least one adult per youth is preferred, and limited space is available, so reserve early. This campout will include hiking, tracking, games, presentations, botany, ecology, astronomy, and more. If you're interested in leading an activity or signing you and your children up for this campout, email me at viviana@umpquawatersheds.org. That's viviana@umpquawatersheds.org. If you can't make the U Creek Youth Campout, we're having another youth campout at Twin Lakes on July 22nd through the 24th.
If you're more interested in a non-overnight activity for younger children, join us for Kids for Nature
from July 11th
to August 16th, Mondays and Tuesdays. This fun activity for elementary-age children includes fun art and educational activities. If you're interested in signing up your young one or attending yourself as an activity leader, you can also email me at viviana@umpquawatersheds.org.
If you love to read and would like to discuss environmental topics with fellow bookworms, try Turning Over a New Leaf Book Club. Turning Over a New Leaf Book Club meets over Zoom every other month and will next meet on Saturday, July 30th. The book to be discussed will be Rivers of Oregon by Tim Palmer, or Scenic Rivers, an American Legacy, also by Tim Palmer. All sessions take place virtually at 5 p.m. on their date. For more information, please email Umpqua Watershed's Director of Education and Outreach, Ryan Kincaid, at her email, ryan@umpquawatersheds.org. That's ryan@umpquawatersheds.org.
Or, if you'd like to share your environmental knowledge with the community by being interviewed for an episode of Living Downstream, email me at viviana@umpquawatersheds.org. That's viviana@umpquawatersheds.org.
For the second part of today's episode, we have Robin Bath, another teacher at a local middle school.
Hello, Robin. Could you tell us where you teach and what you teach?
Hey, Viviana. I teach at Fremont Middle School in Roseburg, Oregon, and I am a seventh grade science teacher.
How long have you been teaching?
It's actually my first year, so we're wrapping up right now, and I've definitely learned a lot.
Oh, cool. Why did you become a teacher?
It actually started off when I was at Umpqua Watersheds. I got to do a lot of environmental education work, especially out in the Oakland School District, and really liked it. So kind of took that time to become a teacher.
What kind of schooling did you have to get to become a teacher? Do you have a degree?
I do, yeah. So, well, regardless, you have to have an undergraduate degree either in education or in your field. So I have an environmental science undergraduate and then went back to school to get a graduate degree in Master's of Arts in teaching.
That's interesting. Where did you go?
I went to George Fox University, which was all remote because there isn't a graduate program in Roseburg, but easy enough to Zoom these days.
What inspired environmental education specifically?
Well, I think just having a science background and having a background in environmental studies kind of lended itself to environmental education and taking what I'd learned about the natural world and then applying that to working with kids and getting them interested in that and engaging youth in that process of falling in love with the outdoors.
Do you have any advice for people considering teaching as their future career?
Definitely. I'd say it can be pretty overwhelming if you just jump right into it. So, you know, if you can take a year and do some part-time, like assisting in classrooms or helping with after-school programs or substitute teaching, it gives you more of a feel of how to work with kids, how to manage a classroom, and figure out if it really is what you want to do, since it's a big commitment once you start.
That sort of brings me to my next question. So what's the most challenging aspect of teaching, would you say?
Definitely classroom management is a big piece because you have, you know, anywhere from 15 to 25 individuals, all with very different needs, different experience, and different backgrounds. And you're trying to, you know, cohesively bring them all together around a subject matter and keep them engaged. And that's balancing different learning styles and different attention spans and different language levels. And all of that just takes a lot of pre-planning and then also on the fly instruction to make the material more attainable to everyone.
Speaking of making material more attainable, do you have any advice for kids who may need some extra help or want a way to expand on their learning? Any resources or study tips, anything like that?
Definitely. I mean, it definitely depends on the school, but once you get older, there's usually some type of assistance after school, like homework help or a homework club that gives you more of a chance to work one-on-one. And, you know, a lot of teachers are there to support you if you want extra help during lunch or even after school. You can usually go talk to your teacher. I think it's when you don't say anything, that's when you start to get into trouble. So people want to help you, but it's learning to ask for help.
Do you have any interesting memories from when you were in middle school?
I do remember I got to be in my eighth grade year, I got to be on the leadership team. So that meant getting to help plan events like dances and rallies and getting to work more with teachers like as a team instead of just a student to teacher relationship. So I really enjoyed that. And I think it helped me prepare for just, you know, to be more of an adult and learn to plan and things like that. But I was also really into sports and got to do a lot of fun sports and go on trips and ski. And it was a great childhood. My middle school experience maybe wasn't as awkwardly traumatic as most.
It's good that you can relate to them and keep in mind their position in life. It sounds like you're really a supporter of extracurriculars. Is that true?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I love that kids can do band and choir. And I have an elective class that you've helped with natural resources. So I think, you know, the core classes are important and doing your homework's important. But if you have the bandwidth and the ability to do things after school or take other classes during the day to get extra skills, I think it's just awesome. And often that's what you remember most because there's usually a lot less stress surrounding it.
You used to be an AmeriCorps member for Umpqua Watersheds like me, as you mentioned earlier. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was all the way back in 2019. So I got to start off pre-pandemic and working in a lot of elementary school classrooms and spending one day a week out at Lincoln Middle School in Oakland. Really hands-on. It was really fun. Got to do a field trip up to Crater Lake with fifth graders. And, you know, like everything, it was all going smoothly until COVID. And then that's when I kicked off the Home Explorer program and kind of focused more on that at-home learning for kids.
About the resources that Umpqua Watersheds provides, such as skull labs, owl pellet dissections, or environmental detectives, did your experience being the one who was working for Umpqua Watersheds as an AmeriCorps member and being the teacher the Umpqua Watersheds AmeriCorps comes to differ? Did that experience differ in any great way that you can think of?
Well, I think that it definitely helped me realize like how to support the AmeriCorps. I feel like as a teacher, I've tried to kind of be clear about what I need from you so that it's easier for you to do your job, because I remember that was a struggle sometimes, is coming into classrooms and just no one knowing what was going on. And then that's usually when, you know, the goal wouldn't be as effective. So learning to plan and prepare and present the material to the students in a way that they are engaged is definitely, I think, been a good practice to have done it before on the other side.
And how did your experience as an AmeriCorps influence your career path and teaching methods?
Well, definitely, it's what led me to be a teacher. So I'd say very relevant to my career. As far as methods, I think it's just given me a whole other arsenal of tools that I can apply to my classroom. And that's why, you know, you've gotten to come into my natural resources class so many times. And I talk about these things with my science students. And, you know, we're able to talk about natural history of the Umpqua just because I've had that background knowledge. So definitely it comes into play a lot, which is really nice and handy.
Over the past few years, STEM has increasingly become STEAM. Two examples of this are the Gyotaku fish and the animal print molds. So do you think that art contributes greatly to education? And if so, in what ways?
Yeah, I definitely think it does. As I mentioned earlier, sort of adjusting what I teach to different learning styles, I think, you know, some kids do really well just taking written notes. And I think it's important to recognize that some kids need to draw out what they're learning and color those pictures and use it as something that they can, you know, take home and show their families and teach them about those topics. So I love incorporating art like the Gyotaku fish or the molds, because that's something that's very tangible for them to, you know, have with them and to also still be learning about the topic as they go.
So speaking of different kinds of experiences in the classroom and different approaches, do you have a favorite kind of classroom experience, such as writing projects, videos, hands-on experiments?
I definitely focus on hands-on experience in my class. It's just definitely very engaging for students and they can learn how to learn from their mistakes, which is important. And I also try to really focus on teamwork and working with a partner or those types of dynamics, because, you know, that's something they'll be doing their whole lives, and learning how to work through those communication issues at a young age will make them more successful in the future.
So did COVID affect your classroom a lot? Have you adopted any new techniques or perspectives because of it?
Well, I was with Umpqua Watersheds when COVID started. So at that point, it was very much lockdown, and, you know, I didn't get to see any kids for about 6 months. And then I switched to working in a school, at an elementary school, as an assistant. And that was definitely interesting, because you got to see how, you know, smaller children were dealing with the pandemic and wearing masks, which for good reason is very hard to keep one on a kindergartner. And then you kind of see how the older kids adjust to it and what those implications are, and how do I adjust my tone of voice so that the students can hear me more clearly, and all those types of things to take into consideration. But ultimately, since my first year of teaching wasn't until 2021 in the fall, being in a classroom, it's the main restriction still in place was masks, but students were able, you know, to still be in closer proximity and talk to each other, and we didn't have Zoom going at the same time. So those types of barriers weren't in place as much, which made it easier this year for me to teach. But I feel that for the teachers who had to teach last year, that was probably much more complicated and trying to balance half the class on Zoom and half the class in person. So I'm grateful I did not have to do that. But I think the one thing that's definitely changed the most is that now every student in the district has a Chromebook. So a lot more of our assignments are done online and all of the grading is online and things that probably wouldn't have progressed as quickly if it hadn't been for COVID.
Do you know about what time everyone did return to in-person class?
At least at the middle school where I work, everyone started coming back at the end of May last year, I believe. And then we started full swing in September of 2021.
You mentioned also teaching some younger children, but that this is your first year. Did you by any chance teach anywhere other than Roseburg or other than Oregon even?
Yeah, I mean, I've taught a couple places in Oregon, but I've had some environmental education experience in Northern California and Lake Tahoe, where I grew up. I got to teach some environmental education through trash and shows. So we would, as high schoolers, we would build outfits out of trash and then go to the elementary schools and put on auditorium presentations so that students could, you know, learn about recycling and the environment. And we would teach them like activities like how to make a wallet out of newspaper and things like that. So it was always helpful to have had those experiences in other places and then bring that back to what I do now in Oregon.
Are there any differences between your experiences there and here, maybe culturally, that you've had to adjust to?
Less so with that position, but I did also live in the Caribbean and taught fourth graders in Trinidad and Tobago. And that was definitely a very different culture as far as the way that school is run. Kids like sit in rows, they don't talk, they're only allowed to raise their hand if they're asked to raise their hand. And it was a much more strict environment in ways. So that was definitely an adjustment in how to work with students and get them to ask questions and not be afraid to make guesses or be wrong and things like that that are important in science. So definitely always try to encourage my students that it's a safe space to make mistakes.
Speaking of safety, how would you suggest that young people in your age range that you teach can engage with the community and the environment in a safe and respectful way?
Well, I think just first off, being aware of your surroundings. So, you know, even if the flower is very pretty, please don't tromp into your neighbor's yard to pick it. So I think just learning those types of rules of, you know, where's public space, where's private space, how, you know, when is it okay to harvest something in the forest versus when you should leave it alone. Definitely for safety learning, you know, what's edible, what's not. We've talked about things like mushrooms and edible flowers and plants in my classes. And I just try to stress the importance of, you know, if you don't know, definitely don't try it. So I think those types of things are important for students to start learning at a young age. And what's great about this area is a lot of kids come in with that knowledge. Roseburg has that nice rural element to it where a lot of students have worked with animals or they've spent time hunting or foraging and they know what they're looking at and then they can teach the peers who don't.
Do you think teaching styles or project types, etc., have changed since you were in middle school pertaining to environmental education or just in general?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to say. Having been so long, there's not that much I specifically remember doing in middle school. One thing I do remember is dissecting a cow eyeball in seventh grade. And I went back and visited my old middle school and they still do that activity. So clearly some things just stick and don't change, but it seems like other things definitely have as far as, you know, the pacing and the use of so many more online materials and just those expectations on homework have changed as well. And that I think people give it out less now than they used to. So I think I'd kind of have to reverse in time and somehow see the assignments I did, but I remember it being fairly hands-on and doing building projects and things that I've tried to replicate in my classroom. So it seems like I think a lot of the hands-on things have definitely stayed the same and maybe more of like the digital work is new.
I'd actually say that from my own personal memory, compared to how I saw that your classroom was run,
I've observed you taking opportunities to go outside when presented, such as to the garden, whenever you can. And I also remember you once saying that you like to allow the kids to stand up every once in a while during class so that they don't get too fidgety. And these were techniques that I don't really remember being around when I was in middle school or high school even. And so what would you say are the benefits of outdoor activities?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, you know, a lot of research out there. And so I can't cite anything specific right now, but focusing on, you know, the importance of getting kids back in nature and getting them off their screens and tuning back in with the outside world. So, I mean, I love that I can do that, that for some students, you know, it's their first time planting a plant or growing something from a seed or even learning how seeds sprout and how roots form. And, you know, trying to cover all those topics is a lot to cover, but it's a really cool way for students to, you know, start to connect with their food and connect with nature and learn how things grow and, you know, start to pay attention to the birds and the insects and feel the difference between the bark of one type of tree and another. And it's things that, I mean, there is no curriculum for that as far as I know, but it's more just, I like to teach the art of observation and hope that that's something that they can keep with them as they get older. And I think students get a lot of benefit from just being up and moving. Like, even though they do walk between their classes, you know, every 50 minutes, there's still a lot of sitting. And it's an age where you need to be up and moving, and it helps, you know, stretch their legs and stretch their minds and just gives them a chance to reset if they're in a funk. So, you know, setting up even something as simple as like, okay, everyone turn in this paper rather than one person turned it in, or everyone go get this supply, or everyone go grab one tool to bring out to the garden, just gets them moving and, you know, keeping them circulating on what we're doing.
So how do you go about planning outdoor education projects?
Well, it's definitely something that takes a lot of time. It's a technique that educators use is backwards design planning. So you think about, at the very beginning, you think about actually, what do you want students to take away from that project? What do you want the end goal to be? What do you hope that they've learned? And then from there, you can try and design what they do in order to help them reach that goal and set postmarks along the way to assess if they've met that goal. And so when I know that I'm going to be taking them outside, or maybe it's for a couple days or even a couple weeks, it's what do we want the finish goal to be? Do they understand what that is? And then, you know, what do I need to give them to make them successful? So things I've done in the past are, you know, working on a nature trail, and we try to make it clear that we want them to be able to collect this type of data, or that we want them to clear this part of the trail, or, you know, this is the vision for what it will look like afterwards, and make sure that we have buy-in from them before that project starts. And then if all that's in place, it can be a lot more successful for students to, you know, get outside, want to be outside, want to spend that time. So for example, at Lincoln Middle School back in 2019, I took the sixth graders out bird watching once a week. And rather than just going outside and handing them a pair of binoculars, we spent several weeks going over, well, you know, it was one day a week, but these are the local birds you're going to see. This is how you bird watch. This is how you use your binoculars. This is how you use a field guide, so that they had all those tools. So then when we did actually go outside, they were able to like, bing, 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 start picking up birds, start identifying them. They knew how to track data. So it made them feel successful really quickly rather than feeling discouraged right off the bat, which is, you want kids to feel comfortable when they go outside and feel excited about what they're doing. Because if you lose their interest early on or their feeling of safety, it can be really hard to get that back.
So I guess that brings me to, do you have any other ideas for ways to get kids to move in the classroom so they don't have to go outside, and especially like the colder months? Anything that they can do in the classroom?
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of rotation stations. So, you know, I'll use the perimeter of the room and set up 10 or 12 stations, and students go stand and either do an activity or read something or answer questions, or maybe there's like a small screen with a video, and then they have to rotate every couple minutes. So it's a really nice way, like we stay inside, but we're up and moving all class, and then maybe we'll come back to our seats right at the end to share and debrief. But it's just a really nice way to keep kids engaged and moving while we're still covering content.
In your experience, what's the best way to establish respectful communication without sparking antagonism with young people?
It definitely depends on the student, but I think just, you know, always making it clear that as teachers, we're there for our students and we really care about them and we want them to succeed, and that, you know, the rules are there for a reason, and that when we approach them and, you know, for whatever reason, there's defiance and, or there's antagonism or negativity, I remind myself that, you know, a lot of this isn't because of how they feel about me. It's how they feel about all adults right now for something that's going on in their lives. And, you know, we just try to be there and be supportive, and, you know, not every day they're going to want to talk to us, but when they're ready, we try to be there.
You mentioned earlier that you've taught younger kids. Could you expand upon how your technique and approach differs between older kids and younger kids?
Yeah, I've never worked with high schoolers, but definitely with the difference between middle school and elementary is a lot, like, it's harder for the younger students to focus on one thing for a prolonged period of time. So just you're switching it up more often or trying to make it even more hands-on. I know those students are still building their writing and their reading skills. So maybe with younger students, you're doing a lot more orally so that they can still understand the content, or, you know, provide a lot more picture examples to help explain what you're talking about. But regardless of the age group, there's just a lot of chances to always ask them how this pertains to their personal life. And that's the idea of social and emotional learning, that students feel a personal connection to what you're covering. Because, like, something, you know, how does this ecosystem relationship remind you of a relationship in your own life? Like something like competition. And often students will think like, oh, I compete with my siblings, you know, for the like best seat in the living room or something like that. So it's regardless of the age, if you can help them connect to the content through their own personal stories, they're going to remember it. And they're also going to want to engage with it more.
What's been your favorite project over the past year?
When I was in my science core, we covered a lot of chemistry, and I really did like the labs there, and that students, you know, would get to cause some type of chemical reaction and get to watch what happens. And you get a lot of those oohs and ahs, and also a lot of mistakes and learning from that. So those were always really fun. And yeah, natural resources, as far as my elective, I really like taking kids outside and growing plants with them, and then doing the environmental detective series, something they really enjoy, and they get to name themselves as detectives and then go on the hunt to discover what's causing stream pollution. So there's lots of cool things that have happened this year. It's hard to name all of them, especially at the end of the year when I'm just overwhelmed thinking back, but definitely there's been a lot of cool things, and Umpqua Watersheds has definitely been a part of that.
And what are you looking forward to in the next year?
Learning from my mistakes, or just trying to improve on what I've done, because I think, you know, especially with the first run through things, you know, they don't all go the way you expect or how you hope, and the best I can do is learn from that and try to improve next year. So I think, for example, with my natural resources class, I would love to take them on a field trip, and we just didn't, you know, I didn't know how to plan one, and we just didn't have the ability to set it up this year. But if something like that's a possibility, that would be awesome to do.
And do you have any tips for homeschooling parents or parents that just want to continue the learning process at home with their kids?
Yeah, well, the beauty of the Chromebooks is that now parents have more direct access to seeing what kids are doing. They can look at students' assignments right there on their Canvas page or whatever program they're using, and can use that to say like, hey, oh, I remember learning about this, or, oh, this reminds me of something that I did when I was in school. So they can, even if kids will do that, how was your day? Oh, it was fine. You can now, you know, go online and see like, oh, I saw that you were learning about this. What do you think? And, you know, use it as a way to help kids dig deeper when they get home. But there's also awesome resources like the Home Explorer and lots of other online tools that let you plan further activities or think of ideas to get kids outside, or, you know, things to do after school that don't involve watching TV. And I think, you know, again, it always takes a bit more work, but the payoff is huge, especially when kids have that power of observation and that joy of being outside when they're older, because that's what really sticks with you.
Finally, do you have any closing comments, announcements, or thoughts?
Yeah, I guess I would say, so the Roseburg School District is offering summer camps, and for middle schoolers, there are going to be, I think, two periods of two-week camps, 4 days a week in the mornings, and students can do gardening and cooking and different sports, and I think there's even a yoga class, so if kids are wanting to get outside and do other activities during the summer, that's a great time to do it, and it's free for all students.
Well, thank you so much for appearing on Living Downstream, Robin. It's been a blast.
Thanks, Viviana. It's been a pleasure.